I think that rather than trying to introduce the topic, you've all probably seen the notice either in a printed flyer or on our website. Further clarification of what we're talking about and why we're talking about it, that should emerge in the course of the presentations. So take it away, Mike.
All right, I'm going to, and how, should be about 10 minutes?
You probably won't go too long, but take the time you need.
Okay. Just let me know when I have about 3 minutes left, if anybody is.
I'll take that.
So I want to talk a little bit about I'm going to divide it up into the sort of old left kind of concept of the Vanguard Party as being necessary to sort of guide the revolution because workers are either burdened with false consciousness or because they have the correct line or whatever, the party that is. I'm going to make a distinction between that and this other expression that's kind of grown up, still having the idea that workers are in some way backward or not quite ready for socialism or need to be brought along in stages, which has come up specifically around different iterations that I've come across with the Occupy movement. The first group, I mean, it's pretty obvious because they say pretty explicitly, these are the Marxist Stalinist left organizations. One is from the Workers' World Party. I just downloaded an essay called Low Wage Capitalism that was written in 2008, and they make it pretty clear. So class consciousness and the fight back, which is one of the subheads. And I just wanted to preface by saying this is going to be a lot of show and tell, a lot of like empirical kind of evidence for the reason why we came around this idea in the meeting. So just to read quickly from Workers' World Party, the strategy of class-wide fight-back concepts such as a right to a job and the right to occupy workplaces, the need for international class solidarity with oppressed workers around the world, and the need for the workers to see themselves as a world class united by their common exploitation. Such concepts cannot be spontaneously arrived at. The intervention of a class-conscious revolutionary vanguard that understands and can promote the ultimate goal of getting rid of exploitation altogether, abolishing capitalism, is indispensable to the struggle. So it's pretty clear what they're about as far as vanguard party politics. They say it's indispensable to the struggle. Consciousness cannot be arrived at spontaneously. Just as a kind of a sub note, they talk in this sort of little leaflet, what will stop imperialism? So their idea of what capitalists, main issue is, as far as crisis goes, is that the contradiction of capitalism that Karl Marx unraveled when it was still in its early stages, capitalist competition drives forward technological innovation, which first makes more profits for the owners because they can shed labor. But eventually that process overwhelms the markets for their products. Workers have no money to buy the greater and greater quantities of goods produced! And a crisis occurs. The privately owned profit system is at war with the socialized character of the productive process. So, clear, basically stating an under-consumptionist thesis, which has been pretty well savaged, I'd say, by Marxist theorists, like the one sitting to the left of me, and others. They have the correct line, but when it comes to describing what capitalism is, it's pretty pat under consumptionism that you can find on from the left and parts of the right. So this is from the Progressive Labor Party. Obama and Romney's goal: war and corporate profits. By the end, they say workers will get nowhere by kicking out one millionaire servant of the bosses or electing another. It's the war-making, impoverishing, job-destroying, racist profit system that has to go. Only the building of a mass international progressive labor party woven into every class struggle can achieve that goal. Only a communist revolution can erect a worker-run society without bosses and profits. Join us, fight for working class rule. This is, just go quick in here. So this is from the paper of the Socialist Alternative Solidarity paper, Justice. And they have a report on Ireland struggling against austerity here. And there's a part in the middle of the little report here. It says the Socialist Party has built the Socialist Party in Ireland, which they are connected with internationally, has built the household tax campaign and put forward an approach that can raise consciousness and win victories. The working class of Ireland has been viewed as passive while enduring 5 years of rapidly declining living standards. That will no longer be the case, as the battle against unfair taxation has the potential to ignite wider class struggle. These events also show the role that socialist ideas, particularly the politics of the Committee for a Workers International, can have in mobilizing people into action and providing leadership in the struggle. So these are all, you know, publications that are clearly tying in the need for a vanguard party, a working party, specifically their party in each, to lead the movement forward. And they sort of sneak into international solidarity campaigns. This was something that Ann and I went to recently, urgent appeal to Occupy and all social justice movements mobilized to defend the Egyptian revolution. This was a report back given by people that went over to Egypt to speak about the progress of the Egyptian revolution. And they're endorsed by the following organizations: International Action Center, LEAP for the Revolutionary Party, and Workers' World Party. They all seem to be very, this one is basically just saying a bit about what some of the repressive measures were taken by the Egyptian state and some of the demands, but vanguard parties are pretty well entrenched in left movements and endorse, worker struggles all over the world. Set this aside for now. So that's pretty basic. I'm just making the case that obviously there are parties on the left, old school Marxist parties, that still believe that the vanguard needs to be the one out in front. It is the more, as let me just read. The vanguard idea is at base the theory that class consciousness necessary for revolutionary success is embodied in an organizational form, in a Marxist party. This is from an essay called The Vanguard Idea that was just written by David Adam, right? That's that, but there's also, I think, and hope to get to a few of these, the vanguard idea as expressed in other sort of generally other movements, generally coming around anarchist type politics, that see their project as increasing or bringing about a class consciousness necessary to revolutionary success, but it's embodied rather in organizational forms that have more horizontal consensus based, all the things that we've come to hear about around Occupy Wall Street. Okay. I've talked about this in earlier meetings, but I think it bears repeating because it's so indicative, I think, of what I've come across and I think what this notion of people aren't quite ready just yet to hear what the real issues are. This is something that was brought up on a discussion group around a design for a publication called Metro Occupy, which is put out by a group around the Occupy Wall Street sort of banner. The designer said that during the design phase, I created an ad about capitalism for the front page, which sparked quite a conversation, controversy really, just within our newspaper group. The ad remained, but capitalism was replaced, quote unquote, capitalism was replaced with corporate state. As someone adamantly declared that using capitalism was too strong, not accurate, and certainly not what regular people would be ready for. She goes on a little further down. It seems to me that the more that we have dedicated conversations, teach-ins, open discussions, etc., the more people will be apt to connect the dots on many failures we are facing and how capitalism plays a direct role. The key is to have non-threatening conversation with the public, which when you include a loaded topic such as capitalism becomes a challenge to everyone's MO. Our work is to dismantle 60 years or so of widespread successful media, which has banished even conversation and inquiry into socialism. How to connect the dots, blah, blah, blah. Right, so here's another kind of iteration of that. This is from, the direct communication of a group called Occupy Theory. They handed this out. I saw this at the premiere of a documentary about Occupy Wall Street. They say, at one point, so they say, modernity might not be so bad if its benefits were widely shared among the population, but they're not. Most don't even view that as unfair. Winner-take-all competition has become one of our dominant cultural themes with all the mythologies of superiority and deservedness that accompany it. So many of our popular shows revolve around this premise. Sports playoffs, cooking competitions, designer competitions, singing, all these talent shows. Much of the problem is internalized. We create the conditions for our own servitude by over-reliance on unnecessary things. Certainly the police, jail, and debt all hold people down, but the most effective tools for repression are the restraints that people carry in their minds and incorporate into their identities. Our basic national and commercial imagery echoes this constantly. Dystopian entertainment makes a fetish of this conceit. People are surrendered to, even embrace, the idea of themselves as pieces of a machine or edgy competitors in a hard world. We need to make internal transformations, and we do that by reaching out to one another. And then at the end, they say, having glimpsed the better world, we will not rest until we have fully actualized it. So they glimpsed a better world. They just didn't talk about it in this pamphlet. They just talked about people were stupid. This is not from OWS specifically. This was from 2005, but it kind of, and it's about the May 68. Workers and student strike and struggle that went down in Paris and all over France in 1968. There's a section that says, the only war that matters is the war of the imagination. Mesmerized by consumer goods, Fox News people aren't going to imagine another world unless you show it to them. Their imaginations have been repressed by this media daze. We need to make a TV show. The world could look like this. We need to use our creative faculties to create that other world so intensely in our imaginations until we can smell and taste it. We have this overwhelming dizziness of media today and we need to use it to our advantage. I'm gonna come back to this. I just wanna talk about, this is,
it's been 13 years.
Okay, all right, I'll end on this. This is from a couple of days ago, July 13th, so about a week ago. With September 17th anniversary on the horizon, debt emerges as a connected thread for OWS. So the article talks about how now debt is going to be the big theme of the next kind of action ramp up, marking the 1 year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. So the article says, even as it carries with it a tone of negation or attack, the call to debt strike also has an affirmative dimension, attuned to OWS principles of mutual aid. To strike debt in this context would also be to create infrastructures of support and care. This is their second negativity, legal, financial, cultural, for those suffering from indebtedness or deliberately taking the risk of debt refusal. Mutual aid in this sense would be a prefigurative opposite of the atomizing, predatory, and fear-mongering debt of Wall Street. And then it goes down and talks about David Graeber's, we can talk about that later, he inspired a kind of debt-moving, rolling debt jubilee that's going to be a big action coming up. Okay, last thing. If debt is a gateway into a radical conversation about the capitalist system itself, strategic and analytical questions arise out of the role of the state, questions that have always haunted OWS as a movement grounded in anarchist principles. So they're problematic as the state, they're anarchists, but clearly that, you know, this is somebody who went to one of our OWS meetings. He's in Occupy Theory. Debt as a gateway into radical conversation about the capitalist system itself. That's a sort of a, that encapsulizes what this new push is about around debt. I've heard it many times, debt is where people are. The idea that you have to go to where people are, talk about what is, you know, first and foremost on their minds because they can't think in, you know, in any kind of totality, and they can't think about capitalism, so we have to sort of, you know, deal with what is on their front burner. And then through that, you can sort of, in stages, bring them more and more consciousness. I mean, it's not explicit, but and you have to tease these things out, but I think it's there. There's other things we can get into that. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. That was Mike. And now we'll hear from Ann Jacquard. Do you want me to give you a time share or anything?
No, just tell me if I'm going on too long, because I have mine all written out, so
okay.
I'll do the whole thing if I can. Okay, I have subtitled my paper, Who is Being Realistic Depends on How You Understand Reality. And for introduction, the left says that Marxist-Humanist initiative is unrealistic to think the masses of people are ready to discuss bringing about socialism. And that same left presupposes that they know the process by which the masses will get ready. We disagree with all of their assumptions. We say the issue is not whether workers use the word, quote, socialism, but whether they're ready to address the idea of fundamental systemic change from the standpoint of a future society. In other words, not just any change, but one that envisions and is pulled by concepts of a future society. We say that how a person hears and sees influences what she thinks. We hear working people raising the question of a new society all over the world today, from demonstrations in Russia and China to the continuing unfinished revolutions in the Middle East, to the new upheavals in Europe against austerity, to strikes and demonstrations here in the U.S. So we think it is the rest of the left that is being unrealistic in its assessment of what is going on and its assumptions about how it is that fundamental change develops. The left's views are premised on an idea that we consider false and therefore unrealistic, that the world can be changed fundamentally and sustainably for the better without a full break with capitalism. And to make such a thoroughgoing break requires a new relationship of theory to practice, we say. A relationship that cannot even begin without discarding the concept of the backwardness of the masses of working people. Tonight we're concentrating on exploring where this backwardness concept comes from and why it persists in order to determine who is being realistic. So I'm going to try to stick fairly narrowly to that issue. The attitude that the masses are backward is nothing new. It was prevalent in socialism, utopian socialism, before Marx, and it's continued in post-Marx Marxism. After the temporary success of the Russian Revolution in 1917, the idea of a vanguard party to lead the backward masses held sway for decades. At the end of Radonevskaya's article, in Eric Fromm's important 1965 International Symposium, Socialist Humanism, and that's this book, which really brought the concepts of socialist humanism onto the world stage to be discussed. And Donevskaya has an article in there And this is how she ends, addressing the persistence of the notion that the masses are backward. She says, the espousal of party notes to party principles as a philosophic principle is another manifestation of the dogma of, quote, the backwardness of the masses, by which intellectuals in state capitalist societies rationalize their contention that the masses must be ordered about, managed, led. Like the ideologists in the West, they forget all too easily that revolutions do not arise in the fullness of time to establish a party machine, but to reconstruct society on a human foundation. Just as party knows their monolithism in politics throttles revolution instead of releasing the creative energy of new millions, so party knows in philosophy stifles thought instead of giving it a new dimension. This is not an academic question for either the East or the West. Marxism is either a theory of liberation or it is nothing. In thought as in life, it lays the basis for achieving a new human dimension without which no society is truly viable. As a Marxist humanist, this appears to me the whole truth of Marxist humanism, both as philosophy and as reality. And there's an online citation as well as this book. So it is, of course, from Dunayevskaya's Marxist Humanism that we are attempting to continue. In case you think this problem pertains only to the outmoded concept of a vanguard party and is not found in the new, quote, anarchist or spontaneous groups, Mike has just shown us that the concept continues everywhere. What I'm going to do is try to discuss the philosophy underlying the persistence of the notion and discuss how your philosophic viewpoint determines not only what is considered realistic. It determines what is considered realistic, but it starts with your philosophic viewpoint. This is no small matter. Your attitude toward the masses of working people is tied to your entire view of revolution, specifically whether that view is being shaped by the perspective of the future or is confined by capitalist ideas. Dunayevskaya said elsewhere, and I'm trying to find the actual quote, that Hegel destroyed all dogmatisms except for the dogma that the masses are backward. And I want to look into that because I think the Hegelian dialectic is the key to understanding ideas. There's an ours. Now, Hegel did not talk about today's left or even about the possibility of socialism. But I'm taking Dunayevskaya's statement as the beginning of an exploration of what's going on, why the left clings to the belief that the masses are backward, even though for the past century and more, mass movements and outright revolutions have erupted frequently, including right now. Hegel's philosophy is a method and result of thinking in which thought is constantly changing and evolving, moving forward or back, comes from somewhere and goes somewhere. Therefore, it cannot freeze the thought of any particular moment into a dogma. Hegel exposes other philosophies as resting on mere assertions, whereas his ideas are tested and developed by the movement of the dialectic itself. It is this process that makes his thinking revolutionary, the opposite of dogmatic. As Marx called Hegel's dialectic, a moving and creating principle. But for Hegel, all of this went on in the realm of thought. There were no people involved. Marx and then Brian Dunayevskaya took Hegel's philosophy out of the realm of pure thought and set it loose in the real world. Their ideas developed by undergoing dialectical negativity, but they do so through and including human beings who think the thoughts and make revolutions in thought and in reality. Now our question for tonight can be rephrased. Who does the thinking and who is too backward to do it? Marx and Dunayevskaya discussed this directly. by studying the history of capitalism and the revolts against it, and concluding that mass revolts themselves create theoretical development, which in turn influences more revolt. What Dunayevskaya saw in Hegel was a two-way relationship between theory and practice, creating a single dialectic of historical development. In Hegel, the dialectic keeps moving and developing ideas unless it gets hung up in a bad idea that leads to a dead end or a, quote, fixed particular that it can't get beyond. So to the left, which has long approached reality from its own fixed particulars, the party, the program, the leadership, even the supposedly spontaneous planning of project after project, like in OWS, whatever it previously determined is the correct vantage point by which to measure revolutionary activity. This is done without regard to what the working class may have in mind for itself, or what might develop if there were an interchange of ideas. So both the pre-Marx socialists and post-Marx Marxists took as their premise that the workers were backward unless they were members of their party or their affinity group and adopted its perspective and goals. Nothing is different today, even in that part of the left which wouldn't be caught dead in a party. Those who rebel against hierarchy and think they're as free as a bird, as Mike has shown, they too operate under elitist assumptions that they know what is best to do to advance left causes and to triumph over, we're not even sure what most of the time, oppression, elitism. The point is that they assume they know what has to happen to change things, and the workers need to become agents of that change by adopting their ideas. So once again, the workers are not seen as a source of ideas, but as objects, as players of a part that comes from others' scripts. Thus, the persistent assumption that, quote, the workers are backward derives from the left's assumption about how ideas and revolutions develop. The dogma continues in full force even outside supposedly, quote, dogmatic parties, which nowadays seems to mean anyone who has an organization is called dogmatics. They actually talk about ideas. Spontaneous have similar assumptions. Like Marxist humanists, they say the workers will rebel on their own and form their own organizations. But unlike us, this happens for them not by a process of development of ideas, but again by the workers, quote, gaining consciousness of the leftist pre-established ideas. Raya Dunayevskaya fought such ideas all her life, and she started an organization that practiced a different attitude toward the working class. Her organization began in 1955 and made the editor of its newspaper a black auto worker, Charles Denby, whose autobiography we have, I think, on the table there. Yeah, we're selling it. And her organization made several workers columnists for the newspaper and leaders within the organization. It made a principle of, quote, listening to the voices from below and publishing them and discussing their stories with the owners of those voices, as well as joining every picket line and helping form new unions and rank and file groups within the unions, as well as extensive work in the black, youth, women's, immigrant, and international solidarity movements. Unlike Spontaneous and Autonomous, however, our interest in the working class extended beyond support and activity. It reached to form new relationships with workers by engaging them in theoretical and philosophical dimensions that informed the work of the intellectuals and made it a major project of the whole organization to contribute to the development of theory. This was not a casual development for Dunayevskaya. It was the lived development of the dialectic as she had spelled it out in what she termed her philosophic moment, 1953, when she wrote some letters, quote, translating Hegel's concept for today's revolutions. The letters and her whole future development were centered around this two-way movement from theory to practice and from practice to theory. The actual unity of theory and practice, she wrote, could explode all previous modes of thought and life and get us into another realm, called the new society. Capitalism could be uprooted and replaced with socialism when there was this unity of theory and practice. And this is very much like Hegel's concept of second negativity, the negation of negation, the positive that emerges with a full release of creativity and forms a new society. Yeah. Too long?
How much longer?
I don't know. How long have I gone?
15.
Again,
I'm
sorry,
but
you get a problem with those?
Pardon?
Oh, well, this is a flyer.
I have a flyer about what we're talking about. Okay. Well, I'll wind up. I'll skip some. Where was it? Okay. The left argument is that people are not ready to talk about socialism because they don't think like socialists. They've bought into the capitalist line, we're told. Workers have bought into the capitalist line that this society is all that's possible to have. The left assumes that thinking about a new society comes, if ever, only at the end of a process of going to demonstrations and having the evils of capitalism exposed, and that people have to come to understand the system incrementally. While the reality is that the working class is most likely to understand the system better than middle class young people because they are working in it and struggling within the system. And also today, everyone knows about the revolts going on in Arab Spring, China, Europe, etc. They are undoubtedly capable of discussing the state of the world today, right now, and they are undoubtedly eager to change it to something different. The left seems to think people have to experience defeat because they have illusions about the system. To think that the Union or the Democrats or someone can fix things for us. Such illusions are barriers, but facing barriers is not the same thing as not being ready, that is, capable of grasping the concepts of socialism here and now. I've got to... Well, maybe I'll skip the rest in the interest of time. We can always come back to this in discussion.
Okay. Yes. Somebody tell me when I'm going on too long.
Sure.
Give
me a signal after 12.
You got it.
Yeah. I have been very interested recently in this topic of tonight's meeting. And I just want to begin with a couple of things that got me interested. One was I had a short interchange by email with David Graeber, one of the people influential in Occupy Wall Street. And he said, well, you know, Occupy Wall Street did more to change consciousness than anything like, you know, we have ever done, you know, so why am I criticizing? And that just threw me because, you know, our project is not to try to change consciousness. So I began to realize that there's an issue here, that we're being misperceived. And I thought it was very strange that the Graeber's claim to success for the occupation of Zuccotti Park was the supposed change in people's consciousness that took place because of raising the issue of 99% versus 1%, when they were actually trying to, what they said was, start rebuilding society as we'd like to see it. That's a direct quote from Graeber. rebuilding society and changing people's consciousness don't seem to be the same thing at all to me. The other reason why this issue has concerned me so much is back in November I published this book, The Failure of Capitalist Production, Underlying Causes of the Great Recession, and most of it's an empirical statistical analysis of the underlying causes of the recession. But the final chapter is called What is to be Undone, and there I look at basically the future and perspectives for the future. And most reactions to the book have been relatively favorable, but even among the people who respond favorably to the book, I've gotten this sense, and some people have said explicitly, that they think that I didn't really say anything concrete, that I really didn't have much explicit to say in the way of proposals for the future. And I was really taken aback because I thought I did. I thought I was very explicit. And I started to try to understand why people had the opposite reaction. And it kind of dawned on me, the Graeber incident also, as a result of that, it kind of dawned on me that people are coming from an entirely different place. They think that people aren't ready for socialism. They think that people have backward consciousness. I don't think that, and so they have all kinds of problems that we don't have, all kinds of problems involving strategy and how you move from here to there, and our minds are in an entirely different place. So, but the message isn't getting across about what we are and what we're doing, and I think it's because people don't realize that we are coming from a different place, so we have to, sort of stop, take stock of the situation, and try to communicate that we're coming from a different place, try to engage with this idea that everybody seems to have, and try to explain why we think they're wrong, even though some things that they say, they point to obvious realities, but how can we understand that differently, and why do we understand that differently than they do? So these are the issues that have been on my mind, and recently I was interviewed about this book, and I was asked a question that pertains very much to tonight's meeting. The interview just was published 2 days ago on the website of New Left Project, which is a British website. It's got a lot of stuff on it. And there are 4 questions in my responses, and I was really thinking very much about this whole issue with people being ready for socialism. When I had to grapple with the last question, and so I just want to read most of my response. The question is, in your analysis, economic crisis is a recurring product of deep structural contradictions which are inherent to capitalism. This implies the need for revolutionary change rather than reform. How do you see such a revolutionary process occurring? This is no small question. So I responded as follows. The key factor is that working people's well-being is deteriorating and in danger of deteriorating much further. They're worried and disgusted by that, and they're disgusted at the great lengths to which policymakers have gone in order to try to save the present system while doing so little to help them and even trying to save the system at their expense. So we've had a big wave of revolts all around the world, not only in economically developed countries, but also throughout the Arab world. Deteriorating well-being and the worry and disgust it engenders aren't the only things behind Arab Spring by any means, but they're important elements. And they were important elements behind the Occupy movement, even though those who dominated the movement chose to downplay them while playing up corporate power, greed, and inequality. The wave of revolts has given the lie to the notion that regular people lack the consciousness to understand their own interests. So it's also given the lie to the notion that raising their consciousness is a crucial component of the revolutionary process. Yeah. Of course, there's a serious lack of access to certain kinds of information and certain explanations of how the economic and political systems function and malfunction. And there's a serious lack of access to certain ideas about what needs to be changed. But these are entirely different matters. Those on the left who complain about false consciousness are referring to people's supposed unwillingness to receive and understand the information, explanations, and ideas. They're supposedly not ready, rather than just their lack of access. As a result, many people in groups on the left have themselves become part of the problem, because they think that people are not ready for the needed information, explanations, and ideas. They don't help to provide them, but instead put forward a lot of superficial stuff that's supposedly more palatable. The widespread acceptance on the left of Margaret Thatcher's TINA doctrine, there is no alternative to capitalism, has also become part of the problem. It's amazing that in the midst of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, in the fall of 2008, when mainstream pundits were saying capitalism was a failed system, most of the left refrained from drawing the same conclusion, at least publicly, and some even denied that the system was in serious crisis. But it makes sense in a way. If greater equality within the existing system is the best realistic alternative, you want to say that the wealth is there to spread around, and the system can afford to spread it around, even in a moment of acute crisis in which a big chunk of the wealth is being destroyed. The rapidity with which the revolts have spread from place to place and the degree to which they have organized themselves are remarkable. And they've erupted rather quickly, more quickly than during the Great Depression. The wave of sit-down strikes that recreated the labor movement in the U.S. didn't come until 7 years into the Depression, December of 1936. So I think that the latest wave of revolts also seriously calls into question the notion that the process of social change has to be a gradual step-by-step one, in which movements start with demands for immediate reforms and move in stages to more and more radical demands, and in which a gradual process of organizing and movement building is crucial. This notion has everything to do with concern over false consciousness. If people lack the consciousness they need, they have to be moved step by step like pieces on a game board. Or they have to acquire the needed consciousness step by step as they move around the game board. But if that's not the problem, we don't have to think like that at all, and that's why we don't. It's true that there hasn't been a widespread explicit demand for revolutionary change in the sense of an anti-capitalist social revolution, but the disgust and worry over deteriorating well-being is pretty total. And already in 2009, a nationwide poll in the U.S., conducted by a respected Republican pollster, that was Scott Rasmussen, found support for capitalism was only marginally greater than support for socialism among low-income people and young adults. Only 37% of respondents under 30 favored capitalism, while almost as many, 33%, favored socialism. Respondents whose income was less than $20,000 favored capitalism by only a 35 to 27% margin. The poll didn't define capitalism or socialism, so we don't know what the people expressed a preference for socialism meant, but one thing is clear, the TINA doctrine, there is no alternative to capitalism, is no longer all-dominating. In any case, and Ann discussed this, what's important isn't whether revolutionary change is explicitly demanded at a certain moment. The things that are important are what people want, whether what they want can be granted within the existing system, and whether if it can't, they'll resign themselves to that fact or try to move beyond the existing system. We'll see, but I'm hopeful, much more hopeful than I was before the economic crisis and the fight back against it. Of course, lots of things can derail the process of total social transformation. One is that aspirations for total change can be channeled down wrong directions, including fascism. This may seem alarmist, but it happened in the Great Depression, though not principally within the working class. And fascism and anti-Semitism are again on the rise, for instance, in Germany, France, the Netherlands, Hungary, and Greece. If the left isn't offering an alternative to mainstream efforts to manage the economic crisis, and it isn't, there's a void that only the far right will fill. Another thing that can derail the process of total social transformation is the one that dominated the thought of Raya Denevskaya, the founder of the philosophy of Marxist humanism. The destruction of the old society and the creation of a new one that really transcends capitalism and makes freedom universal are two different things. The transformation of the Russian Revolution into a state capitalist monstrosity made that clear. So Dunayevskaya stressed that the revolutionary process needs to have what she called dual rhythm. The process of creating the new society has to take place in tandem with the destruction of the old one. And she stressed that in order for this to happen, we need Marx's philosophy of revolution impermanence, the philosophy of unceasing revolution, that's what permanence means, unceasing revolution against all obstacles, regardless of the guises in which they appear, until the moment is finally reached in which a classless, non-racist, non-sexist, genuine human free society is achieved. I think we need to reclaim and further develop all this. One way in which we need to do so is to show that an emancipatory alternative to capitalism is a real historical possibility. So here we're talking about an entirely different project in changing people's consciousness. It's providing them with answers to questions that are on their minds. The widespread belief that an emancipatory alternative isn't possible makes movements hold back and refrain from developing the perspective of total transformation. Why put your life on the line for something that's impossible? So I think that the foremost task of revolutionary thought today is to work out exactly what must be changed in order to have a modern society that isn't governed by the economic laws that govern capitalism, one that isn't actually capitalism in sheep's clothing, and one that's economically viable so that it doesn't revert back to capitalism or collapse or lead to something even worse like warlordism. We don't have to start from scratch. Marx left us a lot of guidance on this, and a few others have recently done some good work on this issue. It's important for working people and social movements to be involved in the process. Indeed, I think they have to take the lead in making sure that this work continues and becomes a top priority, since intellectuals on the left have largely embraced the TINA, there's no alternative doctrine. But working people and social movements can't shoulder all the responsibility here. A lot of sustained attention and hard labor are needed to answer the question of exactly what must be changed. Answers won't arise spontaneously or as byproducts of activism. This is not a question of revolution arising spontaneously. It's a question of answering the question of what do we need to change to have a new society, not arising spontaneously.
13 minutes.
Okay, so answers won't arise spontaneously to this question or as byproducts of activism. It's not a matter of providing consciousness to people who lack it, but of responding productively to people's conscious desire to know whether and how another world is possible. So again, I think that we do speak very concretely and we do have a real perspective, but it's hard for people to hear that because they're coming from a different place, a place in which people have to move step by step along the game board or be moved step by step. And I think we're trying here to communicate why we think differently and why, from our perspective, what we're saying is indeed a realistic and concrete and explicit perspective. But I first want to say a little bit about Marxist Humanist Initiative, this organization. It's a new organization, started just a few years ago as a result of the degradation, decay, and near collapse of a previous Marxist Humanist organization, the one founded by Raya Dunayevskaya. So we emerged from that and we created Marxist Humanist Initiative. And what we're trying to be is, first of all, a new beginning for Marxist humanism. We're trying to do a lot of things differently in order to make sure that degradation that occurred does not occur, in order to make sure that, we want to, not waste decades of our lives like many of us did before, going down dead ends. And having an organization transform into its opposite. So we're dedicated to making sure that that's not the case. So we want to be a new beginning for Marxist humanism and a new organization for a time of crisis. And we were created in the midst of this, global economic crisis, and we're trying to respond to it with analysis of what's gone wrong, and also respond, as I indicated in my remarks here, by responding to the question of what needs to be changed in order to have an emancipatory, you know, free alternative to capitalism, because the lack of that is holding back movements. So what we're trying to do is, we see that the people are struggling for freedom all around the world, and we're trying to meet them with the needed philosophy of revolution. And to people like David Graeber, that seems like we're just haranguing people, but that's based, I guess, on the notion that ideas are private, or that you don't need to work out ideas, and people don't need that ideas in order to affect social change. We think that people do want ideas and are responsive to ideas when they have access to them, and the problem is the lack of access, not the lack of readiness. So that's what we're trying to do. We need a tremendous amount of help from people who want to help, are sympathetic to this project on many, many levels. We need help. We first of all need money, because it takes money to rent this room. We need supporters. We have a category, you know, of relationship with this organization called supporters, people who can help us in that way. At a deeper level, we need people to become members. We're trying to do something that we think is extremely important, but it's very difficult, and it takes resources, and most important resources are the time and energy and effort of people who can help and want to help in a variety of ways. And without that help, we're certainly going to fail. Okay, the best intentions in the world are not going to help us meet the masses of people halfway here. Okay. So we definitely need a tremendous amount of help, and any help that folks can give, please do consider becoming a supporter of this organization. Please do consider becoming a member of this organization and lending your time and energy to it if you want to understand more of what's involved in the concepts of supporter and member. This beige constitution, our bylaws and stuff, refer to that. Definitely talk to us about the break, about all of this during the break. We'd love to talk with you, and our literature is here. So during the break, and maybe at the end of the meeting, please do look at our Marxist humanist literature, and we'll all be happy to, you know, discuss anything, as well as when we come back, we'll be happy to discuss things one-on-one with you. So let's try to come back in about 7 minutes, and then we can have a general discussion.